I'm David Chadwick, and this is News Talk 1110 WBT. Welcome to the program. In case you don't know, this is a faith and values program that tries to intersect different issues in our world through the lenses of faith and values. It's always a pleasure doing the program. Thank you, listeners, for joining me on a weekly basis. Well, I have a special program today, a guy I have known about for a long period of time and a person I just recently was able to meet and connect personally with. His name is Ralph Drollinger. He lives in Washington, D.C. He oversees a ministry called Capital Ministries. It is a ministry to congressmen and our political leaders in the D.C. area. He writes prolifically. But some of you may remember his name from his UCLA basketball playing days, a 7-foot-plus guy who was a stalwart on some of John Wooden's great teams. Ralph, thank you for being with me on the program. Could we talk about UCLA for a second?
Sure. Good to be with you, David.
Well, thanks. I just appreciate your presence. John Wooden, you know, I had the privilege of playing for Dean Smith at North Carolina on the East Coast. He's considered one of the greats. But John Wooden just seems to be one of those figures that is above everybody else. Tell us about John Wooden. What's one great memory you have from your playing days with him?
Well, you know, he passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. And I remember at his memorial service thinking that at UCLA, if you look at the college basketball scene through a proper lens, I think Coach Wooden looked through a proper lens, and that was the idea that in the Western mindset of education, the universities develop the body, soul, and spirit. And so if you look at developing the body through the athletic program of the university, then Coach Wooden becomes a professor. And if he's a professor, he has the most influence over you of any professor because, you know, when you go to the NCAA Final Four every year, which I had the privilege of doing, freshmen were eligible my freshman year, that meant you had Coach Wooden as a professor in the fall quarter, the winter quarter, and the spring quarter. So you had Coach Wooden as your prof every quarter, whereas most profs you had for one quarter or 10 weeks on a quarter system. Relative to influence, that means that it was enormous. And he had the largest classroom, which was Pauley Pavilion, with the smallest amount of students, which was about 12, right?
Right.
So you got all kinds of time to interact with that specific professor. And so he was hugely influential just because of the time you had and the ability through the metaphor of sports to teach life's lessons. So in a broad sense, you know, as you're in your formative years, 18 to 22, it's hugely impacting on your life and your disciplines and your purpose and all that he could impute in those 2 hours a day for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. You know, Ralph, Coach Smith, when I played for him, would always have a practice plan of the day and then a thought at the top of it that we had to memorize before every practice because he wanted to teach us not just how to play the game of basketball, he wanted to teach us how to play the game of life. And there are several that I remember even to this day. You know, one of them is when you fail, admit it, quit it, and forget it. And just a great insight into how to live life. Is there one from Coach Wooden that you remember more than anyone else?
Well, I just remember my freshman year practicing with the varsity. I kept throwing away the outlet pass, which was key to the UCLA offense of the fast break. And I threw away an outlet pass. And, of course, that's like a 4-point turnaround because you have 2 points going one way. And if you throw it away and you've taught all your teammates to run to the other end of the floor, that's 2 points coming back for the other team. So he says, Ralph, you're not to throw away the outlet pass. And I said, yes, sir. About half hour later in practice, I threw away another outlet pass. And he said, Ralph, do you know why you're not to throw away the outlet pass? And I had to kind of parrot what I just said in terms of a numerical advantage on the other end of the court. And then I threw away another outlet pass near the end of practice. And so he stopped practice, sat me down in the middle of the jump circle in the middle of the court, and he had all the teammates gather around, and he looked down at me and says, Ralph, if you ever throw away one more outlet pass, you'll be denied privilege of practice with your teammates. Have I made myself clear? And that's how he went about affecting change in his athletes. I'll never forget that. Hmm. And he totally reversed the whole psychology of practice, that it was a privilege to practice rather than a chore.
Yeah, well, you know, you would emphasize as well as I would just the importance of coaches on young men's lives, wouldn't you? I mean, they just have profound impacts, and the necessity for parents to try to make sure their kids play for a really good, principle-centered man.
Yeah, and really sports and the whole idea of the physical body being connected to the soul and the spirit of a man is genuinely true, I think, biblically. And when you have a good coach who's imputing morals and character into the life of an athlete through the physicality of his body, those are unforgettable training moments in the life of an individual. Certainly they have been in mine.
Yeah, and Coach Smith was a deep man of faith as well, and he used every opportunity he could to make faith a part of his teachings with us, you know, things like saying the Lord's Prayer before each game. But he would use those little quotes every morning, every afternoon, excuse me, when we practiced to get some kind of faith perspective as well. And Coach Wooden did that too, didn't he?
Well, he did, and we had the whole idea of the Pyramid of Success. And people kind of think of the Pyramid of Success as the apex of that whole ideological teaching, which was biblically based, was, you know, to create character and godliness. But the top of Coach Wooden's Pyramid of Success, we have to remember, was competitive greatness. Hmm. And so what he was trying to do was create competitive greatness in his students. And he certainly did that just by his own tenacity and ferocity of his coaching technique. He, like a Bill Walton or even myself, who's not necessarily temperamentally that competitive, he really did teach you how to compete in life. And that might not sound that godly, but, you know, in a capitalistic system where we believe in free enterprise, competition is something, you know, you have to be able to do effectively if you're going to be successful.
Ralph, hold on to that. We want to talk about it when we come back. Ralph Drollinger is my guest. Capital Ministries is his ministry in Washington, D.C. I'm David Chadwick. This is News Talk 1110 WBT. I'm David Chadwick, and this is News Talk 1110 WBT. Welcome back to the program. Again, this is a faith and values program that tries to intersect contemporary issues with faith and values. Thank you for listening, folks. And also, many thanks to my friends at the Terrace Cafe for their sponsorship of the program. Means so much. My guest today is Ralph Drollinger. Ralph is the CEO of Capital Ministries in Washington, D.C., does a lot of ministry with politicians and the folks who are the power brokers of our day in D.C., and he has agreed graciously to be on the program with me today. Ralph played basketball at UCLA in the early 1970s under John Wooden, but his ministry now is what is his passion in life. Ralph, tell us about how you were called to this ministry and what you do.
Well, related to our earlier segment with sports, I was in the sports ministry movement for years after coming out of UCLA, turned down professional contracts for 4 years to play with a team called Athletes in Action, and then I eventually played as the first player signed by the Dallas Mavericks. That didn't last too long because my knees were pretty much shot. And there and after, I was involved in the sports ministry movement, and from that perspective of leading the trade organization of all of America's parachurch sports ministries, I could see from that perspective that the methodology of placing full-time, intentional, deliberate, biblically reliant disciple makers on high school, college, and pro teams was really affecting change in the lives for the sake of the gospel, the sake of, you know, individual relationships with Jesus Christ. That was a very effective methodology to actually put full-time Bible teachers on the campuses of athletes. And so after about 10 or so years post my own basketball career doing that, my wife said to me, why don't we start a similar type organization that reaches political leaders on their campuses? Why don't we start a capital ministry, and that's what it's called, Capital Ministries, to put a good disciple maker, Bible teacher on the campuses of public servants. And so we came up with the idea of putting 50 ministries on 50 state capitals throughout America, eventually D.C., and eventually federal capitals throughout the world. And that's 20 years ago. And by God's grace, we've been able to start ministries in a lot of state capitals in America. And now 6-7 years, we've been in D.C. with a strong ministry in the House and the U.S. Senate to members only. And we've got about 20 ministries now that we've started overseas in as many federal foreign capitals. So that's, in a nutshell, what we do. And we see a lot of biblical basis for that, as well as just a pragmatic methodology.
It's a wonderful ministry, and I know some of the congressmen and senators that you impact there. Tell us more specifically, say in Washington, D.C., what is it that you do with our government leaders?
Well, we have Bible studies with House members and with the U.S. Senate members. We just started the U.S. Senate Bible study 2 years ago, and we have, I think, 20 now that get my weekly Bible study notes, and people can get those at capmin, capmin.org, free every week. It could come to you. I write about an 8-page Bible study, 52 Bible studies a year, on topics that are drilled down biblically and based in Scripture, but then have custom applications to the life of a public servant. And so that goes out probably to 150 of the 535 congressional members in D.C. every week, not only electronically, but we deliver those door to door. And then from that, we have individual Bible studies and discipleship appointments, as well as group Bible studies. So, for instance, on Tuesday morning in the Senate, we rotate senators' offices. We had 10, I think, U.S. senators at the Bible study. And in person, we're going through the book of Philippians, and I'm teaching it through the lens of humility, since that's such an important ingredient, oftentimes leaves a public servant immediately upon arrival on the Hill. And so we've been sauntering through the wonderful epistle of Philippians. I think we're just at the start of chapter 4 right now. And 9 of the 12 freshman senators are believers. And we've been able to coalesce most of them into a new Bible study that several of them host, and we rotate their offices so they have a sense of ownership. And it's just been tremendous. And I think it's the best Bible study I've ever taught, because we have a lot of godly men and women in the U.S. Senate. And there's a different culture there, too, David, because they only have to run or rerun for office every 6 years, whereas in the House, it's every 2 years. And it just creates a different cadence to their lifestyle, because in the House, they're often affected by the tyranny of the urgent, where in the Senate, they're looking at how they can survive for that long period of time. And so they're much more apt to be very consistent in Bible study, because they're not driven by the next election cycle every 2 years.
Fascinating. Well, Ralph, I want to use you today to talk some about one of the topics that I saw you wrote on that I thought was absolutely wonderful. It was on immigration from a biblical perspective. But before we get into that, I would really love for you to talk to our listeners about the mood in Washington, D.C. right now. We have seen one of the most raucous, interesting primary seasons we've ever seen in our lives. And now we have two nominees for the presidency, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Ralph, help us understand what in the world is going on here.
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying spiritually, I think from my purview, we have more believers in the House and the Senate than any time in modern United States history. It's amazing how many strong believers have arrived on the campus. But that's eclipsed, I think, because, frankly, and I'm not the market guru like some are, but they haven't really marketed their successes of passing good, cogent, biblically-based legislation in the House as they should have. And that's because it's often been blocked in the Senate because of cloture. And that's to say that to bring a bill to the floor to get a 51 or a majority vote out of the 100, you have to pass through cloture, which means you have to have 60 votes in order to have it acted on. So that means until biblically based believers have at least 60 votes in the Senate, anything that the House members, who've done, I think, a terrific job of industriously passing good legislation to cure a lot of America's ailments, stalls in the Senate. And that's because people don't understand that we have this blockage in the U.S. Senate because of this old cloture bill.
Ralph, explain to us cloture. I don't understand that.
Well, in layman's term, cloture basically means that you have to have 60% of the Senate agree that something comes to the floor for a majority vote, which means you can use cloture to stop a bill by just not allowing it to be debated and voted on the floor, where you only need 51 out of 100 votes to win the day. And so cloture is used inappropriately, I think, oftentimes to block good biblically based legislation. And that's the easiest way I know how to say it without getting into the weeds.
Mm. And so you just have a very rancorous environment in general than in D.C. right now because people are on opposite ends of the spectrum in their ideologies.
Yeah, for sure. There's basically a secular versus Christian worldview that's battling in D.C. And because God's given us so many men and women who love Christ, I really think the future is bright. But because of the inability of the Senate and the House to market effectively to the masses, the reality of the cloture idea of blocking good things that do come from those Christian members and, you know, biblically believing non-Christian members who want a moral-based law that's rooted in Scripture, you have such a lack of communicating the idea of why things are blocked that now you have in the presidential race the rise of a candidate who's really promising huge change as a result of people's frustration. And that frustration, I think, has fueled Trump's candidacy.
Interesting. Well, we've got about a minute before we need to take another break, but what would a Donald Trump presidency do, in your opinion?
Well, I think biblically, the institution of the church is the causal change of culture, whereas the institution of the state is reflective of the change that's occurring in the lives of individuals. It reflects the health or consensus of the nation rather than the change agent, as many people try to label its purpose inappropriately biblically, I think. And so when you look at, I think, at a Trump presidency, I don't have a problem with him not being that godly, because we're not electing a pastor or a Sunday school teacher. We're electing a leader in the institution of the government. And the institution of the government is charged by God with the purpose of rewarding those who do good and punishing those who do evil. So I always say the presidential candidate doesn't necessarily have to match the criteria of 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, which are the qualifications for an overseer in the church. He has to be, who is it, or who is the person that best will basically protect the country?
Ralph, let me come back to that, if you don't mind, please. Got to take a break. I want to come back to that, the purpose of government, and that's important for people to know. I'm David Chadwick. This is News Talk 1110 WBT. I'm David Chadwick, and this is News Talk 1110 WBT. Welcome back to the program. If you'd like to hear this program in its entirety, go to WBT.com, scroll down to the weekend programs, The David Chadwick Show, and you can listen to this program from beginning to end with my guest, Ralph Drollinger, who is the CEO of Capital Ministries. It is an international ministry that's planted different discipling and Bible studies on many of the major capital cities throughout America, thus the name Capital Ministries, also internationally, but especially in Washington, D.C., where Ralph has Bible studies with members of the House of Representatives, senators, and he's trying to make a difference by teaching biblical norms to them as they process that information to make godly biblical decisions on legislation. Ralph, you were talking before we had to go to break, and forgive me for interrupting you, but it was such an important discussion. You were saying that a Donald Trump presidency really isn't that offensive to you as a Christian because we're not electing a president who's a Sunday school teacher or a pastor. We're trying to elect a leader. Would you pursue that thought some more, please?
Yeah, I think because the criteria for God ordaining the institution of the state is to adjudicate justice. It's to punish those who do evil. You have to ask yourself, what presidential candidate will best fulfill the biblical criteria for the institution of the state? And therefore, I don't really have a problem with Donald Trump not necessarily meeting the biblical qualifications for the leader of the institution of the church, which would be 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. You know, an overseer then must be, and it goes on to list a lot of character qualities, which maybe people think are deficient in our presidential candidates. So I don't put them under that litmus test because it is the institution of the state, not the church. And I think of when Solomon was instructing Rehoboam to lead in Israel in the book of Proverbs. He says, I think it's Proverbs 4, he says to Rehoboam, "Where no oxen are, the manger is clean, but much increase comes through the strength of the ox." And I think that's just really pragmatic shoe leather advice, that when you get someone who's got a can-do ability as a leader, they're going to get some stuff in the barn that you might not exactly like or smells good, but the person is going to be very industrious and effective. And I think we see that even in coaches, where you have coaches that win, but they might not have, you know, the qualifications of a Sunday school teacher, but they're very industrious. And I think with the institution of the state, that's okay. And Solomon seems to be weighing in that regard, as does 1 Peter 2 and Romans 13.
And so you, as a Christian, not necessarily saying you would, but you could vote for a Donald Trump, even though there are parts of his character that for people of faith are really offensive.
That's right. And, you know, an insight into him, too, is that several of our members in the Senate who know them well, one being Senator Jeff Sessions, has actually been proffering, as well as David Perdue from Georgia, Senator Perdue, have been proffering to Donald Trump the idea that if he is elected, would he be willing to host a Capitol Ministries Bible study weekly in the White House, and a joint Bible study, not only for individual spiritual growth, but for organic unity in the nation, a joint Bible study with House Cabinet or White House Cabinet members, as well as himself and House members and Senate members. And so Donald Trump actually wrote me back a personal note saying that he wants to meet and talk about that.
Really?
So I think that there's, I think that there's a real openness by him to do things, and maybe it's motivated out of pragmatism to make America great again. But gosh, I'd love to get in there and teach the Bible. And I think he comes through, you know, when you understand the ministry of Norman Vincent Peale, who was popular in the time that Trump was coming up in New York. He went to Norman Vincent Peale's church. And Norman Vincent Peale had a tendency in his book, The Power of Positive Thinking, to pretty much camp out on Philippians 4, the whole idea of, you know, whatever is true, honorable, right, pure, lovely, of good repute, if there's any excellence, anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on these things. And Donald Trump came up with that understanding of theological perspective, not understanding that, you know, Philippians 4 is preceded by Philippians 1 through 3, which has a whole boatload more of theology to it than I think Norman Vincent Peale preached to Trump. And in a nutshell, Adlai Stevenson, when he was running for the presidency at the time of Peale's prowess, said, "I find the Apostle Peale appalling, and I find the Apostle Paul appealing." And I think that's a really good soundbite of theological contrast between what Trump came up with theologically versus what would be a biblical understanding of true salvation by faith alone in Christ alone.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We only have a couple minutes, so we got to take a break again. So let me go ahead and ask this real quickly. Could Donald Trump be like a King Cyrus in the Bible? You know, when the Jews were in the captivity, a Persian king came into power named Cyrus, and he let them go back to the homeland and not only restored to them all that had been taken from them from by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, but even gave them more than he had taken. Yeah. Could this be a secular man, supposedly, who might be used by God to help his people?
I think so. And I like the fact that he wrote me a personal note saying he's very open to this. And I'm looking forward. He asked me to come and meet with him in New York and talk more about this. So I'm looking forward to that day.
Wow. Well, I might get you back on the program, Ralph, and talk more about that when we get to have
a chance to get.
Yeah, I will. I ask that God would use you to have a powerful influence upon his life. That would be magnificent. Ralph,
I just sent him 60 of my Bible studies. So he's been reading my stuff and actually used my Bible study on the religion of environmentalism in a recent speech in Fresno.
Interesting. Wow. Well, Ralph, we've got to take another break, and let's use that as a nice segue into our last segment, which will give us a chance to look at one of the issues that you're addressing in your writings that I found particularly intriguing, fascinating, and well-written, and that's your views biblically on the subject of immigration. It is a huge problem in our nation today. Many people are confused about it, but there is a biblical perspective on it, and you've given it, and I find it very good. Ralph Drollinger is my guest today. He'll talk about immigration from a biblical perspective in just a moment. I'm David Chadwick. This is News Talk 1110 WBT. I'm David Chadwick, and this is News Talk 1110 WBT. Welcome back to the program. First, thanks again to my friends at the Terrace Cafe. Secondly, if you'd like to hear this program in its entirety with Ralph Drollinger, the head of Capitol Ministries, who works with senators and members of the House of Representatives in D.C., teaching them biblical perspectives on different issues, please feel free to go to WBT.com, scroll down to the David Chadwick Show, and you can hear the program in its entirety. Ralph, again, thanks so much for your time today. This is fascinating, your involvement with our leaders in Washington, D.C. But I want to talk just for this last segment about a subject you've written about that I find so well written, but a subject that causes great consternation in the hearts of sincere people in America on both sides of the aisle, this issue of immigration. And there is a biblical perspective on immigration. So would you begin in our last 10 minutes together just to unwrap, what does the Bible say about immigration?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Thanks for teeing it up. And I would say, as a presupposition to that discussion, it's very important that lawmakers in D.C. have biblical exegesis in order to begin their reasoning process. I always say that I'm pre-political in the sense that I'll give you the instruction map on the seat of the engineer seat in the train. You have to drive it into the right station. And perhaps your job's a little more difficult than mine, but I'll give you the map biblically as to where you should be headed in principle. And with that in mind, every week I try to write a cogent 52 times a year Bible study. It's usually 8 pages of exegesis that will go into issues like you're talking about. And one of those that they really have to think biblically on it would be immigration. And I would say this regarding that, like most of our theological perspectives, they start in the book of Genesis. And it's no different with immigration. When you look through the lens of Genesis 11, you basically have the dispersion after the flood. And God basically doesn't want everybody to coagulate together around the Tower of Babel. And so he gives them different languages in order to scatter them into different nations. And God, I think, through the lens of Genesis 11, is for disparate geographical, political nations throughout the world. And that's part because of the fall of man. If you have a one-world government, which you see mankind comes to in the book of Revelation, that's not what God wants, because in order to combat the fall in Genesis 3, God, I think, creates structures that have independence to one another so as to check one another, and those would be independent nations. So if you begin with what happens after the Tower of Babel, where man tries to be one nation in one world, and God disperses them into different tongues for different tribes and different nations, you have to reason from Genesis 11 that God is pro-individual nations. Now, if you begin with that presupposition, then it demands that those nations have borders or boundaries. And if that's the case, then those borders and boundaries, in order to protect the nation, must be enforced. So that's all to say this. I don't think biblically you can reason that we should have open borders and no clear guidelines relative to a nation's uniqueness or its language group being of one language. I can go that far. And therefore, when you look at the discussion right now, should we have closed borders? Should we protect our borders? I think the scripture says yes. And then if you go further and you look at the nation of Israel, there was definitely, in the Hebrew words used there, a differentiation between a citizen, someone who's trying to become a citizen, and an illegal. And there's three, if people want to go to capmin.org, click on Bible studies and look for this Bible study. I think I've taught it last year. There's definitely three different Hebrew words that talk about those three classifications of a person in a nation. And therefore, God gives specific instructions to how a person in a nation should treat someone who's new to that nation, i.e. a sojourner who's trying to become a citizen, versus how they treat an illegal. And those distinctive words in the Hebrew language will add to the conversation that we shouldn't just be lackadaisical about illegals in the nation. So I think Scripture definitely weighs in on this issue. Mm-hmm.
And Ralph, wouldn't you say also, though, that if someone is here illegally, There is still a call upon the church, especially to be compassionate toward them. Because I've had people ask me, we do a huge ministry here with Latinos, and people say, well, aren't you asking them whether they're documented or not first? And we say, of course not. You know, they're people created in the image of God. They have hunger needs, clothing needs. We care for them as people, and don't ask that question. That's not the job of the church. That's the job of the government. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And it gets back to, I have a Bible study called, Are You a Tritutionalist or a Pentatutionalist? And those are my words, David, so don't try to look them up.
Okay.
But a tritutionalist would be the historic Sunday school position in evangelical churches, where you believe that there's three institutions ordained by God, the church, the family, and the state. I go a step further and believe that not only the church, family, and state have been ordained by God to exist, but also the institution of marriage and the institution of commerce. So I'm what I call myself a Pentatutionalist. And I've done a lot of theological writing on this perspective, because if you look through the lens of 1 Peter 2, where it says, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, the Greek words for, not that you want to get in the weeds here, but the Greek words for human institution, that's kind of a general translation from the Greek. And in the Greek, it's anthropinos katesis, and it basically means for man created. And the active verb there, submit yourself, hupotasso, has the idea of submit yourself, get underneath, for man created. So each institution that God has created, we're to submit ourselves to. So if you look through the lens of submission, I see five institutions, because there's authority-submission relationships throughout the New Testament relative to five different institutions. One would be marriage, where the wife's supposed to submit to the husband. One would be family, the kids submit to the parents. One would be the state, where the citizens submit to the governing authorities. The other would be the church, where the congregants submit to the elders. And the other would be commerce, where the employee is to submit to the employer. And each of those institutions is ordained by God for a specific purpose. For instance, the institution of the state, what it does best is to moralize fallen individuals. It says, you know, it doesn't bear the sword for nothing, Romans 13:4. In other words, if you don't have restraining grace by God's ordination of the institution of the state, you're going to have a nation run amok.
Yeah, chaos.
You're going to have no penalty for sin.
Yeah.
The institution of the church, and this is in no particular order of priority, which is the causal agent of change, which we talked about earlier, is to evangelize, in one word. The institution of marriage is to materialize the next generation, amongst other reasons. The institution of the family is to catechize the next generation, bring up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. And the institution of commerce is to economize a country. And each of those institutions ordained by God, which is evidenced through the fact that there's submission evidenced in each of those organisms ordained by God. Therefore, through the lens of 1 Peter 2:13, it is an institution, an anthropinos katesis, for God created, for man created, I should say. When you look through that lens and you say each of those institutions does what it does best, and if I, as an institutional leader, begin to play in the sandbox of another institution, you get chaos. For instance, the institution of the state, oftentimes in a secular world that's not biblically informed, believes that it does everything best.
Ralph, believe it or not, I got a minute. So,
okay. Well, I'll be real quick. It believes that if it plays in the sandbox of the marriage, it can redefine marriage. It believes if it plays in the sandbox of commerce, that, you know, you get socialism. If it plays in the sandbox of the church, you get theocracy. And so what I try to teach is this biblical worldview of institutions, being a Pentatutionalist, to say that this is how you should think as a policymaker, so that you do and assign to each institution what it does most effectively as ordained by God to accomplish.
So, and you're saying then, obviously, that the government has its responsibility to draw borders, to protect itself against illegal immigration for the health of the nation, the health of the
Absolutely.
Family.
Absolutely. And that's what it does best.
Yeah.
You can't have any other institution try to do that.
Ralph, you are the best. You are so thoughtful, but I got to go. And I appreciate your time so much. Folks, please, love God, love your neighbor. Do those two things. You have a lifetime's worth of work to do. I'm David Chadwick. This is News Talk 1110 WBT.